Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Well, the outlines of this story are pretty simple. Just days before the U.S. war against Iraq began in 2003, three American peacemakers were injured in a car accident. The three thought they were as good as dead. Survival hinged on help from an unlikely source, the enemy, or the people of Iraq, who at the time were being subjected to the U.S. military's shock and awe campaign. The nearest town, Rutba, was considered trouble, a home to Iraqi Fedayeen fighters. To top it off, Americans had bombed a town hospital just 3 days before. But still, the people of Rutba reached out to the Americans, bandaged them up, and sent them on their way. A new book tells the story of Rutba, and its author joins us in just a moment. Later on this hour, the push for free and open access to federally funded research picks up steam. But first up, Greg Barrett and his new book, The Gospel of Rutba, War, Peace, and the Good Samaritan Story in Iraq. Greg Barrett is a former roving correspondent for Gannett News Service and USA Today, who reported from Iraq in 2003. He was just in town doing some speaking. And Greg, so good to have you here.
Thank you, Steve. Good to be here.
Well, what were American peacemakers doing in Iraq after the bombing began in 2003, Greg? Because, you know, an easy conclusion might be they had just absolutely no business being there.
That was my conclusion when I first started doing stories on them before the war. I went out to Chicago. It was an outfit called Voices in the Wilderness, and they had peacemakers going to reside alongside the Iraqis, the everyday Iraqis who were going to be in the middle of this bombing campaign, who really would be the ones suffering the biggest consequences of the war. Everything we were reporting before the war seemed to paint all Iraqis with the face of Saddam Hussein. And reporters, we understood that the people who were going to suffer were the everyday Iraqis. And I heard about these groups of Christians, devout peacemakers, who believed that if a Christian majority nation was going to bomb another nation, any nation, but in this case, an Islamic nation, that they should be residing in the crosshairs of it with the people who were being subjected to this kind of violence. And I thought when I first went out there to meet them in Chicago that they were probably suicidal. They were nuts.
I was going to say, that's pretty close to the truth there, isn't it? I mean, you're just asking for it.
What I met when I went to Chicago, and I met with Kathy Kelly, who was one of the leaders of this group, and the group is called Voices in the Wilderness, but you had other groups like Christian Peacemaker Teams. And what I met was a group of people with courage and conviction and Christians who were walking the talk. They did not think that they could sit on the sidelines and watch a Christian majority nation bomb another nation and sit there and watch it on CNN. They were basically American diplomats.
So they went over there and they were hoping to have what kind of impact, Greg?
They were simply wanting to suffer alongside the people who were being subjected to this. And I don't say, I don't mean suffer necessarily, but to say that we will go into this with you. Compassion is in passion going into something. They were showing compassion for the everyday people who were suffering at the hands of a large military industrial complex. And they were, I say American diplomats, they were Christian diplomats. What they were saying is not all Christians are in favor of this war, not all Americans are in favor of this war, and if our country's going to bomb your country, we're going to be right here to help you however we can.
I mean, that's just breathtaking to me. Just absolutely...
Superheroes.
Yeah, I mean, that's just absolutely amazing to me. And so they went where when they were in Iraq as the shock and awe campaign began that was supposed to be so absolutely incredible? What did they do?
Well, before the war, they would protest outside the UN offices there until they packed up and left. But they would try to get media attention. There was media there as well. I was there before the war started also. I went in with the peacemakers. But they would show signs of children who were likely to be killed or children who had been killed in the first Gulf War. Now, in the first Gulf War, the military strategy was to target the infrastructure, amazing as it sounds, we tried to corrupt their water system. When we hit the electrical grids of Baghdad, we knew it was going to shut down the water treatment plants, and the people would be miserable, and they would have cholera, and there would be deaths. We estimated how many civilian deaths there would be just from cholera. So they protested outside the water treatment plants. Do not bomb this site. Outside hospitals, this is a protected site. Do not bomb this site. They would camp there. And they were called, you know, it was considered that they were trying to obstruct the bombing campaign and the military strategy, and that they were unpatriotic in that sense.
Do you have any sense, was the U.S. government aware they were there?
Oh, very much,
and
yes.
Did they have any impact? Was the U.S. government sort of redirecting its war plans based on the presence of these folks?
Not that I know of.
Yeah.
And Rutpa General Hospital is one. I mean, they weren't camped out at Rutpa General Hospital, but the hospitals were not safe. Rutpa General Hospital was bombed by a special forces unit out of Fort Campbell, Kentucky. I tracked it down to the major who ordered that bombing. Good guy. Stuff happens in war. But they were bombing what they thought was an ammo depot for the Fedayeen. And it was near the hospital. It was on the same grounds. The locals there tell me it wasn't an ammo depot, that actually it was an agricultural building.
Yeah.
And it had fertilizer in it. And the Major James Kafrelis, good guys, he did not mean to burn down that hospital. I believe him. But they were targeting the ammo depot, which is fair game, according to the Fourth Geneva Convention. And he says the secondary explosions proved to him that it was an ammo depot. Maybe. Fertilizer explodes. Think of Timothy McVeigh, right?
Yeah, right.
Well,
right.
They say it was an agricultural building. So it exploded. And it burned down the hospital. The only hospital within 195 miles. The next hospital was in Ramadi.
And just before we leave this, how many peacemakers were in Iraq altogether? Do you have a rough idea?
Well, by the time that the bombing started, probably a couple dozen. And
yeah.
They weren't just from the U.S., they were from Australia, the UK, Korea, South Korea.
Hmm.
They were from all over.
Let's pick up the heart of your story here because, you know, Greg, what happened? The war begins. President Bush unleashes his shock and awe campaign. And these three peacemakers that you focus on in the book, at least in part, are in a taxi when something goes terribly wrong. What happened?
They believe they ran over an unexploded ordnance. Now, they're leaving 9 days into the war. We've been dropping 941 bombs on average per day for those first 9 days. And that's just the U.S. Air Force. That's not the ground ordnance. That's not the ordnance from the U.S. Navy. That's not the ordnance from the Allies. 941 bombs per day. There is a lot of debris on that highway. Now, that's a broad highway going from Baghdad to the Jordanian border.
This is to the west now.
Yes, east to west. It takes 12 hours to go from Baghdad to Amman. I've driven it ridden it twice. On this day, it's in the middle of a war zone on a Saturday, a beautiful Saturday. But it's a war zone, and there are burned out ambulances, buses, cars. There's all sorts of debris, war debris. And they believe they ran over an unexploded ordnance. It blew out the back left tire, left a big hole in it. That's why they think it was probably something that blew up. The taxi driver, an Iraqi, speaks a little bit of English. He's saying, bomb, 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 we've been bombed. It shoots the cab up, it careens off the highway, it flips, and it goes into a 9-foot-deep irrigation ditch that's dry.
And you've been there.
Yes, I've been there. And it's a cobblestone ditch, and it lands on top and rolls. And the three Christian peacemakers, two of them are critically injured in the accident. The driver of the taxi is not that hurt. He had a seatbelt on. Back seats of Iraqi taxis, for some reason, I don't know why, they don't have seatbelts. I've never seen one that does. This one did not. The front seat had seatbelts. Weldon Nicely, a reverend from Seattle, he was in the front seat. He was among the two critically injured. Seatbelt saved his life, but he was injured because the car landed on his side. The taxi driver, the Iraqi, was not badly injured, but he probably lost his family's livelihood, that car.
And the other two in the back seat?
And Cliff Candy, his head hit the top. We believe his head hit the top of the car as it flipped and hit the cobblestone ditch. And cracked it open. He was bleeding profusely. He had what's called raccoon eyes, which is the blood bleeding internally, is usually a sign of a skull fracture. And so they were very worried about him. And Shane Claiborne of The Simple Way Today, better known for his work with The Simple Way out of Philadelphia, he had a dislocated shoulder.
So they're in bad shape.
Two of the three are, yes.
And they're in a very, very bad place to be in bad shape, right?
With the dark blue American passport with the bald eagle on it that is recognized well throughout the world and especially in the Middle East, and their country, they're now stuck in a country that's being bombed by their country, and they have no way out. No communication, no car, no transportation, nothing. They're stuck.
Shock and awe is in full swing, and here they are.
Yep.
So what happens next?
Well, Shane is the one who's least injured and is most coherent of the situation at this time. And really, he's more concerned about their situation than he is about the injuries at this point, because they are stuck here. And he doesn't really want them to be discovered, right? They're 9 feet deep in this ditch, and they hear a car coming almost immediately, a truck. And it's speeding east into the war rather than west out of the war. So that's not a good sign. It sees them in the ditch, and it stops immediately. Three Iraqi men jump out. And Shane at this point is thinking, we're done. You know, we knew what the chances were. And the thing is, they're 73 miles west of the border. They were almost home free.
Almost there.
They were
almost
there. And the three men run down, and they pull Weldon out of the car. He's still struggling to get out because they were afraid the car might explode. And they help the others up to the truck, and they put them in the truck. And Shane doesn't understand the Arabic that's going back and forth, and he doesn't know at this point if they've been kidnapped or if they've been rescued. When the truck takes off toward Baghdad, headed east.
The wrong way as far as they're concerned.
Yeah, very much. He, at this point, figures they've been kidnapped. This isn't a good sign. It immediately, very soon, turns off the highway at the first exit, which goes into Rutba. And Rutba has a bad reputation. Even the peacemakers, these devoted peacemakers, they never stopped in Rutba. Rutba is a hub of the Baathist regime.
Yeah, yeah.
It's got a gritty reputation.
And as you said, the hospital's just been bombed there by the Americans.
Now, they don't know that at this point, but they're going into the drivers of the truck are taking them to Rutba, which is the only hospital. So it makes sense that that's the exit they take. They stop alongside an idling station wagon. And they hand the Americans off to the station wagon because the guys in the truck evidently were going somewhere in a hurry. And the people in the station wagon, they take them, they slide Weldon in all broken up like Evel Knievel after an unsuccessful jump. They slide him into the back. And at this point, Shane is trying to figure out if they've just been sold or if they're still being rescued. And they go into the town. They discover there is no hospital. The hospital was bombed 3 days earlier. And they're taken to a clinic instead, where there is a nurse, a physician's assistant, and two doctors, and a crowd of Iraqis. And this is where they're working. It's a squat little clinic with no electricity, no running water, very few medicines. 12 years of economic sanctions at this point had stripped them of their medicines. And, of course, the bombing finished it off. And the doctor, Farouk Abdulami, walks through and sees the Americans, and he walks up to Shane and he says, why is your country bombing us? He speaks English. This is something a lot of people in the West didn't understand. The doctors, the physicians, the engineers in Iraq all spoke English. They were taught in their universities in English. That was the language they were taught in. They had to speak it. And Shane looks at Dr. Farouk Abdulami and he says, I wish I knew. I wish I could tell you. And in that moment, that dynamic intersection of humanity, you have a connection. You have a connection that's outside Islam, that's outside Christianity, that's outside nationalism. You had a connection of humanity.
But the doctor has no sense that these guys are peacemakers, right? They're just Americans.
Well, yes and no. I mean, they're not in uniform. They have no weapons. And Shane's carrying around what they call their magic sheet. It's this little we brought them back when we went back in 2010. We had them. But in Arabic and in English, it explains what they're doing there. It says, we're here to live alongside everyday Iraqis during war. And it explains we are not soldiers. And the doctor looks at Shane and I'm guessing here, but there's a connection. He sees the fear, the concern, the pain. I mean, a separated shoulder hurts. I've had one. And in that instant, he says, relax. You're okay. You're in Rutpa now. Rutpa, which wasn't a good place to be for Americans, supposedly. You're in Rutpa now. We don't care if you're American or Iraqi or Christian or Muslim. We're going to take care of you. And that's the story where it begins.
And that's just amazing. That's just absolutely amazing that these people picked him up. How lucky were they? I mean, what's your sense looking back on this story now?
It was the first truck. It was the first car. And knowing Iraqis like I did from 2003 and from my return in 2010 and having traveled in the Middle East quite a bit, it doesn't surprise me.
Why?
Because...
That wasn't the answer I expected.
The book, the reason I wrote the book is Shane writes, tells this story in his book, The Irresistible Revolution. He tells it in just a couple of pages. Irresistible Revolution is about a lot more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And when I read those two pages, it resonated with me because I had been in Iraq also, and it was counterintuitive how I was treated. I went into Iraq right before the war at a time when we had nearly 500,000 soldiers already amassed at the border, ready to invade, at a time when we had Tomahawk cruise missiles, hundreds of them, already dialed in for Baghdad. And I expected when I went in, unarmed, with no security, but with these peacemakers trying to report from the street, I expected, best case scenario, I would be spit on, cursed at, maybe beaten, or worse.
Sure.
And my very first day there, I got separated from the group. Because reporters were ADD, we're looking around, we're writing in our pads, we're not paying attention.
I think I can relate to that. Yeah.
And literally, we're at this book fair on Al-Mutanabi Street, a very, very popular book fair in Baghdad. And I'm alone among hundreds and really more than 1,000 Iraqis. This is a very long street, and it's a book fair where people are selling books up and down it. And it's a mass of Iraqis, a mass of the enemy, from what I'm told by the Pentagon. And I figure you're not going to mistake me for an Arab. You know, I am pale, pasty, white.
I would agree with that, yeah.
And as I say in my talks, I wrote in a column back then, it took me 30 minutes before I found my group and my photographer and before I felt back in the fold of my people, of my tribe, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in that 30 minutes, only one man laid a hand on me. And it was so crowded. We're bumping elbows and knees and shoulders. And I'm carrying my satchel and I'm making my way through the mass of the enemy. And finally, toward the end of Al-Mutanabi Street, I feel a hand on my shoulder. And I jerk around, figuring, okay, here it goes. And it's a man, I can still see him. He's wearing a tweed coat with a patch. He looks like a professor. He's middle-aged. And he's pointing at my satchel, and he's saying, the zipper. The zipper of my satchel had come unzipped, and all the jostling through the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
And I had 34,500 Iraqi dinar in my satchel, wadded up with a rubber band, denominations of 250, with Saddam Hussein's pretty picture on it. And it was worth $16. He was afraid a pickpocket was going to take. He was saying to zipper. I looked at him, and he looked back at me like, what, you don't speak English?
Mm-hmm.
He was saying to zipper. Check your zipper.
Wow.
And that was the enemy. And we were treated that way from Baghdad to Basra. We went down to Basra also. We were treated with hospitality and kindness and people saying, we love American culture. We hate the violence. You know, why are you invading us?
Greg, let me just reintroduce this show a bit. I'm going to get right back to your point there. This is we're visiting with Greg Barrett. He's the author of a new book, The Gospel of Rutpa, War, Peace, and the Good Samaritan Story in Iraq, an incredible story of three American peacemakers severely injured at the onset of the U.S. shock and awe campaign, who were rescued by Iraqis and brought back to good health while they were there. You make what of that, this notion that even at the height of this conflict, this war is being raged, and no violence being expressed to you at all by the Iraqis? Again, that's just amazing to me. Where else in the world would you find that?
They were making the distinction between the government and the everyday people. And
they were able to do that even in the height of this incredibly emotional time over there.
Maybe they're able to do it better over there than even here, because there was no illusion of democracy. They know there's a distinction between the regime and the people.
Mm-hmm.
And quick story, 2000, I'm in Cairo, after 9-11 rather, 2011, I mean 2001. And I'm in Cairo doing a series of stories about the perspective of us from there. And I went to my driver, interpreter, wanted me to go to this protest going on down in Cairo. And it was one of the few that Hosni Mubarak had allowed. And it's a mass protest. We're talking 300 riot police surrounded in a bull ring. I don't want to go into there. And they're protesting some Israeli-American day, some anniversary for Israel. And they're burning the American flag and the Israeli flag. And I'm thinking I have no business in that circle. But I go in, and I'm treated with hospitality and respect. But the people kept saying, "We love your culture. We love the American culture. We hate your government. We hate your government. Mm. We love your culture." And, you know, I think that Motown and Hollywood and stuff are good diplomats for us around the globe. But they were making the distinction between the government and the people. And I think they were giving us more credit than we deserved. And if you think about it, in 2001, this is right after the first, the Bush-Gore election, right? The hanging chads. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of dispute. So I figured that they didn't think we really were electing our government officials. And you could make the argument. But
yeah.
They give us that break. They give us that slack that, okay, the government's not your doing. We hate your government, but we like you.
If our listeners want to chime in here with questions for Greg Barrett, again, our phone number, 816-235-2888, our email address, updatedate@kcur.org, or tweet us at KCUR UpToDate. Well, continue the story then. Let's go back to the main narrative here. They're being treated at this clinic in Ruppa, and then what happens?
They're getting ready to leave. Well, as they're being treated, now they have no running water and no medicines. Cliff's head is split open.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a physician's assistant, Jasim Muhammad Jamil, who starts to stitch it back together, but he has no painkillers or anything. He's pinching this massive wound on Cliff's skull together, and he's taking the needle and the suture, and he's threading it through this pinched skin.
I'm wincing, by the way.
Yeah. And with each stitch, he whispers in Cliff's ear, "Asif, Asif, Asif." He's saying sorry. Sorry. Mm. Sorry. 7 years later, I met Jasim when we went back to fill this story out some and do the research and see how these people are doing today. And I asked him, I said, "Why were you apologizing? You saved Cliff's life. He's credited with saving Cliff's life. Why were you apologizing?" And he said, "Iraqis are used to getting stitched without any painkillers. You know, we're used to it. But I knew the Americans weren't, so I felt bad that I had to stitch without any painkillers." That's incredible to me. but as they're getting ready to leave the clinic, they get Cliff stitched up. They get Weldon stabilized as much as they can. It was touch and go with Weldon. And they put Shane in a sling. And they have an SUV of some other peacemakers who circled back around, who were also leaving that day, and came back and found them. They load them in an SUV to take them to Jordan, to take them to the electricity and water and medicines of Amman, Jordan. And as they're leaving, Shane gathers up the group's Iraqi dinar, everything that's left. It's a stack of Iraqi dinar, again, probably not worth very much, but to the Iraqis worth a lot. And he carries it over to Dr. Farouk Adulami, and he says, "You know, it isn't much, but we so appreciate the care you gave us and the love you showed us. And we want to give you this as a token of our appreciation." And Shane says now, you know, he sees the stupidity in that, you know, it was such a Western response, you know, money's the cure-all.
Yeah.
And tried to hand it to the doctor, and the doctor refused it. And he looked appalled. He looked insulted. And he's told Shane, he said, "Keep your money. Keep your money. We don't want your money. This isn't why we did it. We did it because you're our brothers. You know, we did it because we cared.
Wow.
We cared for you." But he said, "Please do me this one favor. Go and tell the world about Rutba." And Rutba, again, had this gritty, mean reputation, so mean that the peacemakers didn't even go there. But go tell the world about Rutba that, in effect, we're all the same. Stop believing your politics.
Yeah.
Stop going along with Washington and the Pentagon. We're all together in this. We live under one blue sky. We have one creator.
Yeah.
We're in the same family.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our great conversation about the Gospel of Rutba, War, Peace, and the Good Samaritan story in Iraq with the author, Greg Barrett. We'll talk a little more about Greg, about how he first heard this story. And later on this hour, we'll talk about the push for free and open access to federally funded research and all that, and how it's picking up steam. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed Friday's local music show, you can find it and all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the show, how much of your groceries end up in the garbage can? We'll talk about the environmental effects of food waste, and we'll get some tips on how to use up leftovers instead of throwing them all out. Well, this hour, we're visiting with Greg Barrett and his new book, The Gospel of Rutba, War, Peace, and the Good Samaritan Story, an amazing story about three peacemakers in Iraq at the height of the Shock and Awe campaign who were injured, and how Iraqis themselves reached out to these three peacemakers and brought them back to good health. Our phone number here again, 816-235-2888, if you want to join our conversation. Greg, how did you first hear about this story? How did it come across your plate there?
Well, I was Shane Claiborne and Cliff Candy and Weldon. They were with the same peacemaking group that I'd gone into Iraq with in 2003. So I was connected to that group. I had left. I did not have the courage and the conviction of these peacemakers. I was not in there as a credentialed journalist through the Baptist Party.
Mm-hmm.
I was a journalist reporting for a wire service, Gannett News Service from the USA Today GNS Bureau in D.C.
Yeah.
But I had gone in without journalist credentials so that I could speak with the everyday Iraqis without Saddam's minders, what we call minders, attached to me.
You could get away without them right next to you?
Probably not. I mean, they weren't so obvious. They weren't perched on my shoulders, but they were certainly keeping an eye on the peacemakers. And you had spooks pretty much wherever you went. So I don't know how effective it was, to mm-hmm. be honest, to go in as that. It certainly was didn't hurt me talking with everyday Iraqis and trying to get something authentic and genuine and not scripted.
Yeah.
So I knew of the peace group. I knew of the accident. And like I said, the Irresistible Revolution, Shane mentions it in a couple of pages. And then I was doing a book reading in Chicago on my first book, The Gospel of Father Joe, about a slum priest working in Bangkok, working with the slum imam and the slum abbot, another interfaith story.
Mm-hmm.
And Kathy Kelly out of Chicago with Voices in the Wilderness. She's been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize three times. She's a wonderful, gritty woman, no larger than Mother Teresa. And she'd been to Iraq when I went with her, and that was her 20th trip into Iraq. And she came to the book reading. And after the reading, we were talking, having coffee, and I suggested a book on her. She's a hero of mine in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, go write about Shane Claiborne first, because he's an up-and-comer. And I said, well, Shane's just written a book, Irresistible Revolution. But in that book, that story of Rutba really resonated with me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I pulled the group together. It took a year to get everybody together and get their schedules straight.
And go back over.
And go back to Rutba to see now, 7 years, this was 2010, to see now how are these people doing? Are they even still alive? How are they living 7 years after the war?
And what did you find?
A hospital that has been rebuilt, has a new surgical theater, and isn't operating. Literally. Their electricity is suspect, intermittent.
Still.
In the whole town, even though it gets complicated, actually. It's not necessarily because of the war. It is and it isn't. But the hospital, you've got this new shiny hospital that's a clinic. I mean, people still, it serves 20, 30, it's 20,000 people in town, 50 in the region, 50,000 in the region, but they still have to go to Ramadi even for labor and delivery, which is 195 miles away. Can you imagine that? Just where I live in the D.C. area, I've done the math. For the book, I mean, I've got like 9 hospitals within a 15, 20-mile radius of me, and these people have one 195 miles away, 50,000 people.
And the good doctor is still there?
Dr. Farouk?
Yeah.
He's a wise man. He went on to the hospitals in Ramadi where they have electricity.
Yeah. He got tired of that. Yeah.
And another doctor had been killed in a car bombing. And Jassim Muhammad Jamil, who stitched Cliff's head together, he was there. Fantastic man. When he heard that the Americans had returned, he said his first thought was they must have forgotten something, like a computer or a wallet. And he said, it is amazing to me that you've come all this way and ignored all these risks just to say thank you and to see what you can do for me now, that do for us. That this is incredible. You are acting like very good Muslims, only without the prayers, the daily prayers.
Well, I'm just wondering, Greg, as you get around the country, what impact has this book had? What kind of feedback are you getting from your readers and folks who come across your story here?
Usually I'm speaking in churches that are already up to speed on this stuff, and so it's just reaffirming. But I tell you where it needs to be told is in college classrooms, on college campuses, and it is in the curriculum at Duke University in a program at the Stafford School of Public Policy, and they've been teaching the other book, my other book as well. But I lectured there. The students had read the book as part of their curriculum. Mm. They'd written point-of-view essays about the book. And then I got to speak to them, and it was a very dynamic moment because it wasn't me talking. It was us having a conversation. And what I found was so surprising, which surprised me, was that these bright students of Duke University, freshmen and sophomores, they were not aware of all the circumstances of the Iraq War until they read the book, many of them. Some of them did not know what shock and awe meant.
Yeah.
They didn't know about the WMD. They thought that they were going around believing that we had gone into Iraq simply as a humanitarian purpose to help the people. And that is dangerous because history will repeat itself unless we educate the new generation about this stuff. I had one question from a girl, an engineering student, aeronautical engineering. She was in tears. She said she read the book. She didn't realize the power of the military-industrial complex. She didn't realize the roles that Raytheon and Boeing and Lockheed and General Dynamics and Textron and all these places play. She got into aeronautical engineering to make rover craft, but she's being told that when she graduates, she can make 6 figures if she goes to work making stuff that helps with the military defense.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
She said she doesn't want to. She doesn't want that life. And what should she do? She's asking me, what should she do? And I said, follow your heart, follow your passion, don't sell out.
You know, Greg, one of the points just along the lines you're talking about right now that you talk about in this book is your deep concerns about some of the weapons that we used over there, weapons like bunker busters. What are bunker busters?
I'd have to look in the book and figure and write everything I had researched. But they go deep. In other words, they penetrate. Yeah, they're what, 400-pound bombs, but they have such heat. They melt through the bunkers. They penetrate deep enough, and they are hot enough to penetrate the metal and kill whoever's in that bunker. They nothing stops it.
Now, you talk about a lesson that's come out of this experience for you, and that's this need for people to get out of their comfort zones and get to know people who are different than themselves. Tell us about that, and what are you talking about exactly there?
I think that we all go around, and myself included, in our comfort zones. And our comfort zones can be defined in so many different ways, but our economic class, our religious affiliation, our political fraternity, our ethnic race, all these things, we go around, we run with basically the same crowd our whole life. And I was forced out of my comfort zone professionally. I mean, I'm being paid to go to these, as I say, these cordoned off corners of the world to do reporting. Otherwise, I wouldn't be there. I mean, I'm going to go to Cancun on my vacation. I'm not going to go to the slums of Klung Toi in Bangkok or to Rutba in the western Al Anbar province of Iraq. And whenever I get outside that comfort zone and I meet the so-called enemy on common ground, I discover things that we have in common. And as Desmond Tutu says in the foreword to the Rutba book, that when we meet on common ground like that, when we look one another in the eyes, we see someone we recognize, and we see family. And if we look even deeper, we start to see a reflection of ourselves.
So what's next for you? What's the next book project?
Well, we're working on a documentary. If anyone has $124,000 to drop on it, we're trying to tell.
I saw you're trying to get this thing off the ground, yeah.
Yeah, we brought a filmmaker back with us to try and do more what Dr. Farouk asked and tell the story of Rutba and try to break some of these stereotypes and try to bring people together on common ground. And we had this great filmmaker, Jamie Moffat, come back with us out of Philadelphia. And we have all the material, but we still don't have $124,000 to put this thing together. And documentaries, they don't make money, so people don't invest in them. And it's unfortunate. So we've got a whole lot of raw material and no means to really put it all together and get it out there. And,
well,
and
good
do
luck
the promotion.
With that.
Thank you.
Greg Barrett was in town for a talk he gave last night at an event sponsored by Peace Christian Church. And so interesting to have you here, Greg. Enjoyed it.
Thanks very much.
That's Greg Barrett. He's the author of the new book, The Gospel of Rutba, War, Peace, and the Good Samaritan Story in Iraq.